Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Take a moment to imagine what it must have been like for the first humans who learned how to ride horses. People had domesticated other animals before horses, cows for example, but nothing that moved that fast. Imagine generations of humans navigating the world primarily on foot, and then, all of a sudden, this powerful animal, with whom you develop a relationship, gives you a new kind of mobility, speed, and ultimately military prowess. It was a major sea change in human history. There is a theory, espoused in particular by anthropologist David W. Anthony, that we owe to horses the languages that many of us speak, as well as other aspects of our culture. A language that linguists call Proto-Indo-European, the ancestor to modern-day Indo-European languages, is thought to have spread in part due to the rapid dispersal of peoples made possible by the domestication of horses. Modern Indo-European languages encompass many European languages, from English to French, Portuguese, Dutch, German, and Spanish to Russian, as well as Hindu, Urdu, and Punjabi. The domestication of horses also played an important role in military history, allowing those who mastered cavalry of different sorts to quickly overtake other cultures, and led to the first major form of globalization. To discuss this history, I spoke with anthropologist William Taylor. William Taylor was fascinated by animals from an early age. He grew up in a household full of pets. He was also a hunter and was always curious about the differences between domestic and wild animals. When he started studying archaeology, he discovered that this discipline provided the perfect opportunity to examine relationships between humans and animals and the way they evolved over time. He is currently assistant professor of archaeology at the University of Colorado Boulder, as well as the curator of archaeology at their Museum of Natural History. He has ongoing field projects in the Great Plains and the American Southwest, as well as Mongolia and the steppes of Central Asia. He also conducts museum collections research in China, Australia, and South America. The main focus of his research has been the horse. I began by asking him, where do horses come from?
So, you know, horses are really the most recent branch of a really, really long lineage of critters that really stretches all the way back to basically the end of the dinosaurs, right? And the rise of mammals 50, 60 million years ago. And the thing that's made horses and their ancestors special is their evolution and adaptation to a whole host of things, but in particular to life in grassland environments. Horses are incredibly fast. Their herd behavior kind of helps them navigate against predators in these open environments. They're really, really good and creative at different ways of eating, chewing, and digesting and processing grass. And horses and their closest relatives, donkeys, asses, zebras, and these kind of things. They evolved primarily in the grasslands of North America at about 2 to 4 million years ago, the time period that we associate with the onset of the last ice age. And at various points during the last, say, 3 million years, changes in ice and sea level have connected or separated the Americas from Eurasia. And so it was at one of these periods of connectivity that horses dispersed out of North America into Eurasia, Africa, and at different points, South America as well. Then, of course, we see a sort of diversification into the various equids that we know today, as well as many others that didn't quite make it into the modern era. And then essentially from the very earliest period in which we had hominins that look or act in similar ways to us, dispersing out of Africa, this sort of coming into contact with these last ice age Pleistocene era equids of one flavor or another. And so wild horses are really among the very first species that we have any evidence of humans engaging in direct hunting behavior. We have a couple of these incredible smoking gun type sites in Europe, the most classic of which is this German kind of lake shore called Schöningen. And it was not just the horses, but these incredible spears. Somehow or another, the conditions conspired to like preserve these wooden spears that were used to hunt the horses in these lake sediments. And so We have this incredibly deep, probably deeper than any other taxon, the established connection between humans and horses, especially in that hunter-prey role, goes back essentially to the dawn of humanity.
Wow. So going back to North America for a moment, so my understanding is that although horses evolved in North America, at some point they go extinct in North America. Is that because of climate? Is that because of overhunting? Do we know why that happens?
Yeah, that's a changing, our knowledge of that story is changing. I mean, fundamentally, those earliest horses were kind of a cold grassland adapted animal. And of course, most of what we would consider human history, right, is really taking place within the last 10, 15,000 years, in which there's been this incredible change from like this last glacial maximum planet, in which temperatures were cold, a lot of areas were very different than they are today ecologically. And of course, part of that warming is the temporary reconnection of North America and Eurasia, which were separated not necessarily by sea, but in fact by ice for quite a while. And so there was this period of connectivity that brought people over the Bering Straits and into the Americas. And so there are a lot of things happening in North America at this time. We know that from the very moment that the first Americans set foot on the North American continent here, that they were engaged in some way or another with horses. We have sites, for example, quite a famous site in Wally's Beach in Alberta, that's got the horses laid out along with the very tools used to butcher them, right, after a successful hunt. Other localities, pretty wide ranging in their geographic extent. For example, there's sites in the Ocilla River region in Florida where sort of beautiful bone tools have been made out of horse remains dating to this very earliest Holocene period, right, within the last 13, 14,000 years. So we certainly know that folks encountered horses here in North America. We know that they made use of them, that they had a relationship with them in terms of hunting, but also using the horse to make tools. Over time, our technology is changing a little bit, allowing us to see different things beyond simply the skeletal materials that might preserve. And so in more recent years, for example, we found that in higher latitudes where perhaps the ecology and the climate may be a little bit less different from a kind of an ice age environment, right? For example, in the high Arctic of Alaska, that the wild horse that lived in this continent might have survived much later into the Holocene. A decade or so ago, there was an argument based on the sedimentary DNA, you know, so sort of generic DNA that's still making its way into the environment, might push that more like 8 or 9,000 years ago. And then last year, there was a paper that might have pushed that needle even towards 4 or 5,000 years ago. You know, clearly folks were hunting horses involved with that process because it was also linked to this very significant environmental changes. The trajectory of the horse was probably different in different areas. They might have gone, quote unquote, extinct locally from a number of regions, especially the further south you go, quite rapidly. And horses might have persisted in a more significant way for much, much longer in other areas.
So when you talk about sedimentary DNA, I'm curious how you're able to get the DNA. What is it in the fossil record that you're finding that you're able to extract DNA from?
I mean, basically, you know, again, I'm no geneticist, but it's an improvement in the ability to capture and process fragments of DNA, right? So, I mean, DNA is this incredibly complex molecule, and as it breaks down, it's not necessarily exploding into irrevocable components. But initially, we really needed like very, very good preservation of close to the whole shebang in order to make a lot of sense of it. And over time, these techniques, the kind of shotguns capture technology, allowing us to take a lot of very small fragments and identify and interpret them. And so there's a lot less you can do with sedimentary DNA in terms of it's not going to tell you the the level of completeness or detail as a well-preserved, fully sequenced bit of DNA that you might get from a bone melting out of the ice or some of these more high-profile discoveries, but very nicely can tell you kind of a snapshot of which animals were in the environment, because perhaps we can find enough fragments that we can say, okay, there's definitely a horse in this sort of overall environment at this time. The challenge is, of course, dating the animals that are contributing to something like a lake bed or a soil profile. It's like, of course, that's an average of a much longer period of time than a single specimen, like a piece of bone might be as well. And so it can be harder to interpret and this sort of thing, but it's really emerging as this very valuable tool for understanding changes in ancient environments over time periods that we might not necessarily have coverage of what's happening with those animals in the fossil record directly.
Sounds like an exciting time to be an anthropologist, like the analogy of this case moving. So let's talk about the domestication of horses. So what do we know about that? Where did it happen? When?
So this is stuff that's, again, once again, changing very, very rapidly. So for quite a long time, archaeologists have been focused on understanding this question because it's really quite central to our understanding of human history. Horse transport, for example, really revolutionized the way folks get around, travel, connect. Domestic horses as livestock are this very, very crucial species in many parts of the world. But horse cultures have tended to leave quite a shallow signature in the archaeological record overall, right? Horses are very mobile animals, and you know, the people that use them have tended to be pretty mobile as well. And so we're not necessarily dealing with these vast sort of cities or meters and meters of beautiful stratified archaeological deposits filled with detailed clues about those earliest human horse relationships. And so our ability to trace that process of domestication in many ways has hinged on our ability to link human behavior to the kinds of materials that we do recover. And those have tended to be primarily bones. The bones of horses themselves from archaeological sites are the sort of the central data set that we have with which to understand horse domestication. And so our picture is constantly changing based on our ability to squeeze information from those bones. So 50 years ago, when folks were sitting down to write about this, they literally were having to look at changes in where are bones found, how many bones are there, right, at an archaeological site, and how did this change over time, or how big are the bones? These very, very simple and very indirect metrics that don't really connect directly to people in any easily understandable way. Nonetheless, folks had ideas, right? There was this clear sense that horses are a grassland animal. They came from Eurasia, you know, they're domesticated in Eurasia here somewhere. And so the search is always focused on the Eurasian steppe in some way or another. The question has sort of been which part and when. As we started to get some tools for tracing that human-horse relationship more directly, for example, little indicators, osteological indicators that might be related to the use of horse equipment or this sort of thing, we kind of settled in on some early ideas. A lot of those ideas hinged on this time period, maybe 3000 BC or slightly earlier, in which we see evidence of a lot of folks moving around, migrating out of Eastern Europe and the Black Sea region in all directions. So there's evidence that folks moved into Central Europe. There's evidence that folks moved out of the Black Sea and kind of contemporary Ukraine region as far as the Altai Mountains in deep inner Asia, southern Russia, even Mongolia, even as far as Central Mongolia. This is, you know, quite nicely established population movements. You know, so folks have been knowing what we know about horses and their ability to allow people to travel for a long time. I've been interested in whether that migration, which sometimes is called the Indo-European hypothesis because it's linked with the kind of Indo-European language, sometimes known as the Kurgan hypothesis because it's linked with a certain set of mound building burial practices, this sort of thing, whether that was linked with horses. It's been quite a a longstanding idea. So as our tools to trace information about people from bones has changed, the specific configuration of that idea has changed a little bit. And so an initial search for that type of evidence from kind of Ukraine region, there was a well-known site for a while that was like, here's a site which we think dates to kind of the fourth millennium BC, and it has damage to the teeth of a horse, which look like they're caused by a mouthpiece of a bridle, a bit. And then lo and behold, they actually directly dated the material, and it's much, much younger than expected, right? So then the hypothesis has shifted around to fit different archaeological sites. And the most recent one over the last maybe 10, 15 years has been a site that's actually outside the Black Sea region, but not so far away in kind of northwestern Kazakhstan. And this is a site with some funky patterning and sort of potential damage to the teeth, some kind of isotopic evidence that comes from ceramics, which definitely suggests the processing of horse fats. And an argument was made that it represented the processing of horse milk, and just all horses, so many horses, horse bones everywhere, right? And so up until quite recently, that was, you know, pretty much the accepted starting point for our understanding of horse domestication. And this is a site that dates also to this time period of kind of mid-fourth millennium BC, and kind of might help explain that Indo-European movements and this sort of thing. The problem is that the more that our technology improves, the more information we have, and the new information coming out, particularly from both human and animal genomics, just really don't line up really nicely with that existing idea. For example, when folks analyzed the genomes of the horse remains from this site in northwestern Kazakhstan, Botai, it turns out they're actually a different species entirely. So they're not related whatsoever to the lineages that would become domestic horses. And so I've found myself embroiled in a bit of a debate over what does that mean. Some folks have interpreted that as saying, okay, this means there was an earlier domestication attempt, essentially, of a sister taxon. Listeners who know about horses or, you know, been to the zoo might know the Equus Przewalski, right? Or Przewalski's or Przewalski's horse. They're quite a beautiful animal, and they're quite closely related to modern horses, but they're very much a different taxon. And within recorded history, have no relationship as a domestic animal to people. That finding got me and a colleague of mine interested in kind of reevaluating whether that osteological evidence at Botai actually was really reliably telling us about horse transport. And so we did a careful comparison of that material to a large assemblage of wild animals from the North American Pleistocene, the Ice Age wild horses here. And we argued that, in fact, all the changes that folks identified on some of those teeth in Botai were in fact phenomena that occur naturally under certain conditions, a kind of a natural developmental issue. And so I'd say that's an active ongoing piece of the debate as we're trying to kind of make sense of the new findings and the new results. What is not up for debate anymore is that the origins of the animal that did become the domestic horse are now pretty clearly established with a large scale kind of dating and genomic sequencing of horse bones from across the continent. And this research really points us back again, once again, to the Black Sea region, but to right around 2000 BC. This is also the time period where horses that are clearly domestic make their first appearance in the archaeological sense. We see horses popping up in human burials alongside wheels and bridles and some of these things, which, you know, it's very impossible to argue that they were being used for transportation. And so the genomic evidence and the archaeological evidence kind of converging on that story, that it's really this Black Sea region that was the homeland for the animal that became the domestic horse. You know, we still have a lot to learn about that first domestication process, but what I will say is it's quite soon, if not immediately, after horses first appear there in a domestic sense, that horse transport in the form of chariots. And in some areas, this was just a sort of a spread of horses and chariots. In other areas, it was quite a nasty kind of conquest situation. But they really radiated outward from that Black Sea region, you know, westward into Europe, southward into kind of Anatolia and the Mediterranean, eastward as far as kind of the Altai and even into Mongolia, you know, relatively quickly after their initial appearance in the archaeological record.
Okay, so let me restate my understanding of some of what you've said, and then I have a couple of questions. So in essence, we don't know for sure when horses were first domesticated. An older theory was that it may have happened around 3500 BC, roughly, right? With the Bataille theory. You and your colleague, it sounds like there's an open debate about that. There are some problems with that theory. It sounds like we know for sure that there were domesticated horses around 2000 BC in this Black Sea area. Am I getting it right so far?
Yeah, that's right.
So I guess one of my questions is, if the 2000 BC date is more accurate or something closer to that, is that in keeping with the theory that the domestication of horses may have had something to do with the spread of Proto-Indo-European or some version of that language, or does that complicate that theory?
Well, you know, this is a very interesting question because, you know, in general, this area is a sort of most likely, and again, I want to telegraph to the listeners, I am not a linguist, so I'm a consumer of other people's ideas and information. But in general, this area was likely home to folks speaking some kind of, you know, early Indo-European-like thing. And it probably was that way at 3500 BC. It probably was that way around 2000 BC. And so did the horse play a role in helping disperse folks that spoke a kind of an Indo-European type language into other parts of the continent? I think absolutely. I mean, there are little areas you can point to and pick out cases in which there's stronger or weaker evidence for that sort of thing. Languages are a hard thing for us to trace archaeologically unless they're written down, right? And so a lot of these things are based on kind of inferences based on contemporary languages or lots of lines of evidence that I'm not particularly well versed in. But one thing that I think is interesting to note is that that horse-related dispersal, the kind of post-2000 BC, it certainly wasn't exclusively a dispersal of Indo-European-speaking folks. In many ways, it was a dispersal of horse-using folks. And there were cases, for example, you know, one of the earliest places that domestic horses sort of trickled into and started to shake things up was the kind of Eastern Mediterranean, Anatolia, this region. There are a lot of different kinds of languages going on there. And some of them were, for example, speaking some kind of Semitic language. But one group, often referred to as the Hyksos, likely a Semitic language speaking group, those are the ones who took horses and chariots and used them in the conquest of ancient Egypt in the second millennium BC. And so I do think the horse had a role in changing the distribution of folks that spoke Indo-European languages. It is also important to note that there were definitely early dispersals of folks that probably predated the domestic horse. One of the ones that gets a lot of the attention is known as the Yamnaya culture, right? And those folks spread all the way across the continent. We have Yamnaya-like genomes from a culture called the Afanasyevo or Afanasyev culture in the heart of central Mongolia. And that's a long way to go. So far, we have absolutely no evidence that horses played any sort of role in it, right? And so it may simply have been their adoption of wheeled vehicles and, you know, they certainly had cattle carts and transport that would allow them to do long distance migrations. And so it may be that we need to think of horses and their impact on people as one step in a much broader pattern of animal transport increasing folks' mobility and increasing their ability to move around and migrate and this sort of thing.
Do we think that carts may have been pulled then by cattle before horses, possibly?
They absolutely were. And in fact, cattle are probably the first animal in which we have clear evidence of their use in transport. There's still some work to do in pinning this stuff down. And there are other taxa, in particular the donkey, in which there's also quite early evidence. But it seems likely that folks really sorted out animal transport on cattle first and then began to apply some of the strategies learned to other animals. So the two real earliest instances of animals being used for transport are probably cattle in probably what began as a kind of agricultural activity, whether it be in far Western Asia or some folks like to point the finger at Eastern Europe. They're kind of a connected sphere 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. And then the other real early region is donkeys show up being used for some kind of transport activity around 3,000 BC in Egypt, if not before. And in that case as well, it's pretty likely that the use there is pack work for moving agricultural products and stuff. And then that system matured into having some other uses. These worlds kind of collided, and you had what began as cattle carts then being pulled by donkeys in much of kind of the Near East and Western Asia. Folks started to take these very rough, clunky kind of four-wheeled cattle wagons, and pretty much right away they were finding ways to use them to kill each other in warfare and right. This sort of thing. But then they got streamlined. So donkeys are a little bit faster than cattle. Folks began to breed donkeys with wild humans, wild ass. And they're even produce even faster animals and using both four-wheel and two-wheel carts in the kind of Near East. All this stuff preceded the first sort of hint of horse transport in the archaeological record. That's not necessarily in the same exact area, but it is part of that chapter of the human story. So by the time we had, for example, these Yomnaya migrations, we have already in the kind of Caucasus region folks that were building and using cattle carts and quite clearly able to use these to move longer distances. So there's some really cool burials from the Caucasus region with cattle that were buried even with the nose rings used to control them still in position right on the front of their face there.
Wow. When's that from roughly?
Oh, I'm going to get this wrong, but somewhere, you know, maybe 3,500 BC-ish. Definitely fourth millennium BC.
So I'm thinking, first of all, it's easy to imagine that cattle were easier to harness than horses. But I imagine that once you start harnessing animals, you're looking at those horses and thinking, boy, they're pretty fast. It would be interesting to see what could happen if we could get one of those to pull a cart, right? Yeah. So you've talked a bit about warfare. You used the word conquest earlier. I think you were talking about Egypt. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of horses in warfare, what we know about that and what the impact might have been on human history?
So I think horses are pretty interesting because their impact in different parts of the world has been a very, very different one. Obviously, the most universal impact of horses is their role in transport and combat and warfare, right? I think what the archaeological record tells us is that pretty much across the board, their first and biggest impacts have been in kind of grassland areas where folks can breed horses in greater numbers. And horses are having a lot of other impacts in many ways first. So in some corners of the world, like North and South America, that impact primarily for helping in hunting wild animals. In Eurasia, a lot of the really key impacts of early horses are as either helping to herd other domestic livestock or as a livestock animal themselves. And so I want to point that out before we end up talking about the more gruesome battlefield stuff. But one thing that this ability to control horses and to raise them in larger numbers is conferred upon whoever did that, this incredible set of advantages in their ability to travel, communicate, but also on the battlefield. And I think pretty much wherever horses spread, folks figured that out pretty quickly, that all of a sudden they had this ability to raid their neighbors, you know, to sort of impose their will upon others. And so we see that the domestication of horses really did kick off a series of different kinds of spreads. On the one hand, you had folks in more temperate northern latitudes, areas with grasslands and horse habitats, kind of figuring out, hey, this is an incredible livestock animal. And there were social changes that accompanied that. But in other areas, the role of horse was primarily more what you might call a technology, right? Or a tool, you know, a key to political power or military power. And so, you know, we don't know a ton about those early horse-linked catastrophes because it was very, very deep in the past. But things like the, you know, the Hyksos invasion of Egypt, or there's a similarly hypothesized invasion of kind of Indo-European type folks into South Asia, into the Indus Valley region. And so I think the introduction of horses was very different depending on which model was being applied. As sort of in horse country, it might have been a relatively like empowering, pleasant process, not necessarily even involving too much turnover in the local population or that sort of thing, where in others it was like, oh, here come this foreign warrior invasion, and it involved a bit more turmoil.
So when you talk about horse-linked catastrophes, are you talking about a horse culture that comes and invades a culture that is not a horse warrior culture?
Yeah, like a military toppling of a relatively long and stable social setting. We saw this stuff take place really all across the Eurasian continent during the second millennium BC as the geopolitics of a whole continent reorganized so that instead of control over like river valleys and grain and kind of religious authority, all of a sudden it was like, how close are you to the steppes and how quickly can you get horses and chariots and this sort of thing became very influential factors in the political outcomes of early states and polities.
Well, one of the figures who gets cited in that history sometimes is Genghis Khan. How do you locate him in that history?
I mean, so Genghis Khan or in Mongolian Chinggis, he's really just the most emblematic of a really, really long history of these incredible early global empires that formed using the steppes as kind of the glue. He's quite late in the story of people and horses. In many ways, he's the sort of the last hurrah, right? Before the sort of mechanization era and all of these things has sort of changed the value of horses as a political tool. But really, we can follow the same pattern of these global empires back much, much deeper, millennia deeper into the past, at least as far back as the first millennium BC, when folks, you know, there were multiple stages in the relationship of people and horses there. There were a couple of really important inflection points. Shift towards a mounted riding cavalry type approach. When folks really began mounted riding in a kind of combat type situations, we really had these very, very global empires emerging right in the middle of nowhere, basically, right? With places like the frigid steppes of Mongolia now being these incredible urban centers of connectivity with the Mediterranean, with China. And that really became a very, very cyclical common pattern in Inner Asia many, many centuries before Genghis Khan and the Mongol Empire, really kind of emblematic of this type of Inner Asian state that began to emerge with the mid to late first millennium BC.
So do you think it's fair to say that the horse is one of the first vehicles of globalization in that sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I think as we really reached peak horse mania in the first millennium BC, folks realized there's some quite funny historical anecdotes. For example, in China, as you know, folks had kind of a dismissive attitude for a while about riding a horse because it was a sort of uncouth, you know, barbarian type activity. So there's some funny notes where people are like, guys, we really have to, it's time that we, you know, put on the trousers and get rid of our pride and start learning how to do this. As the continent kind of scrambled to navigate this situation in which large numbers of riding horses were really the key to maintaining grip over your political authority. On the one hand, everyone was seeking to develop these connections with the grassland areas that could raise horses in much larger numbers. But on the other hand, folks like, for example, in China, demand for horses meant that if we're in conflict with the folks that live in horse country, we have to get them from somewhere, right? And so demand for horses helped forge those early pathways of the Silk Road that go through the harsh deserts of Western China and into the heart of Central Asia. These are not necessarily natural travel corridors in an ecological sense. There's a lot of desolate country out there. But the mountains of Inner Asia, the mountains of Western China, Central Asia, they became an alternative supplier of horses. And so the driving force for some of these early, quite formalized expeditions by Chinese states to the West, the driving force was really the need for horses. And so you had this dual process playing out where the Eurasian steppes really stretch from the edges of Korean Peninsula all the way to Eastern Europe with various little interruptions and such between. And so you have this natural pull effect happening at the steppes from every direction there. But then you also have folks that are kind of left on the outside looking in and desiring to build those networks of horse supply and exchange, also looking elsewhere alongside. And so I really do think that the horses were the driving force that forged those first trans-Eurasian connections in particular.
So interesting. So coming back to your work for a minute, you've done some field work in the steppes there. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience there and what you've done?
Yeah, so I kind of cut my teeth in archaeology in Mongolia, actually. I started going to Mongolia as a student, and I kind of learned how to do archaeology directly from some really wonderful Mongolian scholars. And it's a part of the world where horses are still very much deeply enmeshed in day-to-day life. You know, many areas of Mongolia, it's still how you get around. It's, you know, folks use horses day-to-day to herd their livestock. And so that was really where my deep interest in kind of steppe horse archaeology kind of developed out of that contemporary connection with this Mongolian culture that's still so centered around the horse. I did my dissertation work trying to poke at the earliest origins of horse culture in Mongolia from an archaeological sense. And then since that time, I've been fortunate enough to be able to moonlight and connect with other scholars and projects working in different parts of the continent. So I did a couple of projects in Kyrgyzstan. I've managed to partner with some really incredible Chinese colleagues working in different areas of China. And yeah, I think it's over the last decade or so developed a real strong interest in trying to connect Mongolia and my understanding of the archaeological record there with these other areas of the ancient world. And haven't always done that through field work. It's oftentimes just by, you know, forging connections with scholars that really know their stuff. It's very, very hard to understand a whole new part of the world. And so the key to it is in many ways working with folks that have spent their whole careers in Russia or in Kazakhstan or in Kyrgyzstan or China and just sharing ideas.
Yeah, well, I'm impressed by the breadth of your knowledge, I have to say. I'm curious, you talked about how in Mongolia, horse culture is still so central. Did you have any experiences there that you felt like gave you some sort of insight into the past?
You know, I've had a lot, and you know, some folks do some more explicit study in which they do something called ethnoarchaeology, right? Which is try to kind of study what's going on today and directly apply it to the past. With my own experience, it's been much less formal, and it's more about, like, I've kind of learned about horses from talking and chatting with Mongolian folks, and the discoveries are kind of, they're kind of a constant stream of, oh, I never thought about that, or, oh, I should think about, and just one example of that, a few years ago, I had a friend of mine who was traveling around kind of talking to horse folks, and he was telling me about one of his trips, and he showed me some pictures, and I realized there's this incredible tradition of dentistry that contemporary Mongolian folks kind of do their own veterinary dentistry on their horses. So they remove kind of the deciduous teeth when they come in wrong. There's a certain kind of tooth that's a vestigial tooth on a horse that doesn't always show up, but when it does, it can kind of cause some problems with the bit of a bridle. And I realized, wow, folks these days are actually doing a lot of their own dentistry, and I wonder how far this goes back. So I sat down with some real knowledgeable folks and we talked about, you know, what they do, how they do it. And then we just decided, let's go explore the collections that we've been studying and see, can we trace some of these dentistry practices deeper in the past? And we found evidence of veterinary dentistry going back to 3,200 years ago, to 1200 BC. And I've been looking at these same horse bones for 6 years by that point, and it never occurred to me that encoded in some of the materials that we're looking at might be evidence of intentional veterinary care going on, because we just didn't know to look for it in the first place. And so it's important, I think, to constantly be engaged in that dialogue with folks that really know in such a deep level this system of care. It's not that the modern approach is the same as the past, but that knowledge of horse behavior, horse care, it has a very, very long tradition. And the most important pieces of it that are around today have been vetted through centuries of practice and understanding. And so for me, one of the most important things about understanding the archaeology was learning Mongolian language and allowing me the chance to just talk to folks directly so that I could be absorbing things accidentally that I didn't know I needed to know.
Sounds like a pretty exciting job. Coming up, we will continue to discuss horses with a focus on equine therapy, a contemporary manifestation of the ever-evolving relationship between humans and horses. If you would like to reach out to me with any thoughts or ideas, suggestions, please send me an email at askwith, that's A-S-Q-U-I-T-H, .intheweeds@gmail.com. Remember to tell friends to subscribe to In the Weeds. We'll be back soon.